You're listening to Radio Rehab, the most informative substance abuse program on the airways. Your host is Lisa Seif, who's the director of the Ward County Court Substance Abuse Program. You can pick up the phone right now and give Lisa a call at 812-424-1400. Or if you're outside of Evansville, it's 1-888-846-7867. Radio Rehab. And now, here's Lisa Seif.
State. This is Lisa Seif with Radio Rehab. We are filling in for And So It Goes today because of the weather, and we are going to try to stretch our Radio Rehab show to an hour, and we certainly won't have any trouble doing that. So be sure to call in if you have any questions, 424-1400. Nothing is below the belt here at Radio Rehab. We really want this to be an opportunity for you to ask questions and us work with you and partner with our community so that we can have chemically free people and clean and sober folks in our neighborhoods and churches that are happy, joyous, and free. So we want to work together to make that happen. And today for our first hour show, we have an incredible human being that has moved to Evansville, Indiana a couple years ago, and his whole career is based on making this community a better place. From Park Avenue to Park Bench, this guy is everywhere, hearing stories and sharing stories. Today I have Mizell Stewart, who's the editor of The Courier, visiting us and sharing his story with us today. Good morning, Mizell.
Good morning, Lisa.
Thanks so much for coming.
I'm really glad to be here.
I'm glad you are here. We were talking a little ahead of time about you and your story, and I know people will be excited to hear that. And thanks for being so candid about you and the things that have shaped you, and I'm sure we're all ready to hear about it. Tell us about you.
I'll tell you, it's amazing to be on a radio program like this and interacting with folks who've been dealing with substance abuse and addiction issues. And literally a lot of my life has been shaped by that in my own family. I was talking to Lisa before before we came on the air, and one of my earliest memories of the newspaper, quite literally, is a time when my dad used to take me to the bar with him. My mother was a teacher and taught me how to read at a very early age. And so, you know, imagine this 3-year-old kid reading the newspaper. And my dad used to like to show me off. And he literally would take me to the bar with him and newspaper curled up under my arm. And we'd walk into the bar. He would put me up on a bar stool. He'd stack a couple of phone books up so that I could actually spread the paper out in front of me. And guys would walk by and see this guy and this little boy reading a newspaper in the bar, and almost like a conversation piece.
Mm-hmm.
And go, you know, what, Stuart, what is this kid up here? What is he doing here? And what is he doing with that newspaper? And my dad would say, well, that's my boy, and my boy can read that newspaper.
And they're like, sure, sure.
And they're like, yeah, right. You know, there is no way that there's no way that kid can read a newspaper. And so he'd have me read something, and the guy standing there would go, no, he's memorized that. He's clearly memorized that. And my dad would go, well, you know, if you put something up, I'll show you how much he can really read. So he'd motion to the bartender, and the bartender would bring a couple of Strohs up.
Strohs.
And and he'd just sit there and wait, because, you know, the bartender, you know, he knows what's going on here.
And he's seen the routine.
He's seen the routine. And so my dad would turn over the guy and say, okay, you know, flip the page, any page in the newspaper you want. And so he'd flip to a page and point to something, and I'd sit there and read it because I could read it. And Dad would get his beer paid for. I'd get all the accolades from all of the guys in the bar. And by the end of the night, Dad was happy. Dad was drunk, but he was happy.
Yeah.
And, you know, it was a great father and son bonding experience.
For sure.
Little did I know that, you know, little I know, though, at that age, that already my dad had a drinking problem.
Wow. Did you know that your reading at that point in your life was something special, or were you just at that point doing what dad was proud of?
Doing what mom and what mom and dad said that I should do. It wasn't until many years later that I realized that was it was pretty unusual for a 3-year-old to read, and even more unusual for a 3-year-old to read the paper
at a bar.
But that's, and I tell that story, and I tell that story quite a bit, actually.
That's an incredible story.
Because, to me, it's one reason why I work in the newspaper business and have ever since I was 16, and why they've always been a part of my life, and why I'm privileged and proud to be the editor of the Courier, because a newspaper is one of the elements that binds a community together. In a typical community, there may be 7 or 8 radio stations, 3 or 4 television stations, but by and large, in this day and age, there's one paper. And
yes.
And so it's a community's public square in that way, and I think a real touch point for people in getting to know the community, and for a newspaper to reflect the community.
So I'm sure when you were a 3-year-old reading at the bar, and then later in life reading became way more important to you, you probably had no clue how this is your father's alcoholism really was what was responsible for your reinforcement of reading in the newspaper.
There was a great deal of positive reinforcement that happened in that bar, especially you give a kid does good, and dad gives you a roll of quarters and sends you to the bowling machine and says, go have fun. I mean, those were the fondest memories I have of my father were the time that we spent together in that in that bar.
And did you grow up pretty close to your father then, from then on?
Yes, we were very close, but Dad was a restless kind of guy, and he was when I was very little, he worked for the post office in Cleveland, Ohio, and but always had big dreams, and always had big dreams, and always wanted to. Wanted to make something of himself and be somebody, and I think I know I got that got that desire from
that ambition
from him, and that ambition from him. My mom, as I mentioned, was a teacher, and responsible both for taking care of the house and contributing as she did in the classroom, but my mom really had to become the rock of our family as my father's addiction began to really really take hold. And there were arguments, there was physical violence, there was a period of time literally from the time I was 7 until my parents split when I was 9, that you could really at that age, the fun times with dad were gone.
Right.
It was, it was a lot of
chaos.
Dad hanging around with the fellas and coming home to my mother, who was none too happy that he was not at home.
And you at 9. Well, 7 and 9, kids really do get it, don't they?
Well, that's really when it really came into focus that things were not right, and that you're thinking, when is dad going to stop drinking beer?
Yeah.
I don't know how any, as a kid, you just sit there and you wonder, that's 1, that's 2, that's 3, that's 4. When is enough enough?
Wow. So really, children, do you think even that young start to link that the drinking is what's causing the problem in the family.
There was no doubt in my mind.
So when parents say, "Oh, they don't know we're drinking like this," yes, the kids do.
Yes, the kids do. And I would come home sometimes. If my mom was sensitive enough to send us. By the time I was. I was 8 or 9. I had a younger brother, and when she thought things were going to get a little dicey, she would send us to a neighbor's house so that we wouldn't be around when Dad came home, because invariably he would come home and he would be. He'd be drinking, he'd be violent. And to my mom's credit, she didn't want us to.
She was protecting you.
Didn't want us to experience that. And so, again, when Dad's not drinking, when I don't see that red, white, and blue Budweiser can around, Dad's fine. But, when I see that Budweiser can around, and I see those empties piling up, something's getting ready to jump off here.
When I worked at the Mulberry Center, we used to ask children to draw the most important thing to their mommy or daddy that had the drinking or drug problem. I can't tell you how many children would draw a beer can or a glass of wine or a shot. So, they get it.
Ubiquitous. When Dad was ready to get lit up, he was ready to get lit up.
And the family can tell.
He was there. Absolutely.
They feel it.
Absolutely. And so the violence at home just quite literally escalated. The most vivid memory was literally a time when my mom felt threatened enough to call the police.
Were you all home then?
We were home then, and she felt threatened enough to call the police, and Dad quite literally got in a fight with the police in the middle of the street in front of the house.
Because he was so intoxicated, not like him.
He was, and this was a female police officer, and no woman was going to take him to jail. No woman was going to take him.
It was bad enough your mother made the call, not another woman coming to get him.
Absolutely. So things had escalated literally to a point where mom needed to leave the home, and eventually they divorced when I was 9 and my brother was 2.
Jeez, you think the violence was what escalated the divorce? She'd have hung in there had he not.
I think her concern was, my mother's concern was. This is not an environment that she wanted my brother or I to be in, and she was fully capable of earning a living, and so
she was pretty independent.
And so, quite literally, one summer, my brother and I were packed off to my grandmother's house for the summer, and by the time we came back to Ohio from visiting with Grandma, we had a new apartment, and we started a new life.
Jeez. So was reading your escape through all that still? Did you always stay a good reader?
It really was. And reading, and I'd say reading and music were the two things that when I was young really kept me going. I would kind of withdraw into that, my own little world, and dream of that future. I remember that summer at my grandmother's, where I would, I would sit on the porch and I'd read the paper, and my grandmother loved to collect jazz records, and so I'd have the jazz playing on the stereo in the background, and I'd be sitting on the porch in a rocking chair and in my own little world.
Kind of created your own world.
Absolutely.
Well, audience, don't go away. We've just got to take a commercial break. Mizell Stewart is visiting with us, sharing his story, and has just started to talk about his life as a young person. And we'll continue hearing his story when we get back from a break. So don't go away. Well, maybe we get to still go through the break, Mizell.
It's all right.
Good. All right. Okay, let's keep going. So you got into jazz and you got into reading while all of this was going on in your family. I'm sure it affected you, though, to see your mother hurt and struggling, and your dad, who you obviously loved and have a lot of traits like him, probably.
Well, you know, things were different, but yet, you know, it was pretty easy to understand why things had to change.
Yeah.
It was very easy to, you know, was you know, obviously not happy about having to, you know, go to a new school and leave old friends and all that was necessary to make that break with
your dad,
the life that we had.
So you had to relocate to a whole different community?
Yes, we did. And that was, you know, again, it was, on the one hand, it was hard, but on the other hand, you know, you develop, and I think this is true of a lot of children who grow up in homes that are affected by substance abuse. You develop a kind of resilience.
Mm-hmm.
If you're fortunate, as I was, to have supportive parent, to
grandparents
have resources
too.
Grandparents, in terms of being able to, you know, was, I think it was a great coping mechanism for my mother to be able to pack my brother and I off and send us to her mother's house for 2 months at a stretch.
That was a nice reprieve.
You know, that was time for my mom. That was time for that she had actually to return to school, and you know, during those summers while we were away. That was the time that she spent getting a master's degree.
Mm.
And you know, we had some, as a family, I mean, yes, we had some challenges, but we also had some built-in advantages. I mean, it was an advantage for my mother to be an educator.
Mm-hmm.
So there was not as intense an issue during breaks from school about childcare.
Mm-hmm.
For example, I mean, there were some built-in advantages. I mean, my mother
How to take care of things.
She knew how to, you know, She knew how to stretch. You know,
mm-hmm.
She knew how to stretch a dollar. And and my brother and I, even though we were separate from our dad, you know, we never suffered for anything.
Mm-hmm.
There was never a period where there was something we wanted that we didn't have access to, and so that was good.
Do you think children that suffer from alcoholism or addictive behaviors in their families that don't have a mother or other adults around them that have resources, those children end up more resentful earlier in the streets?
Huge challenges. I mean, I can...
Because alcoholism just ravages a family.
It really does. And it sneaks up on you. I mean,
absolutely.
I think that was, you know, my experience was that, hanging out with Dad at the bar was fun.
Right. He was enjoying his drinking at that point.
Until being around Dad was not fun.
Right. And he wasn't enjoying it anymore either.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so there's just a threshold that's crossed, and it's
exactly right.
It's hard to
you can't identify it.
It's hard to pinpoint when
they call it the invisible line.
Mm. But you know, I cannot imagine the challenges that kids who grow up where perhaps both parents are addicted.
Yeah.
Where they find that
resilience
and have that. And again, I had some advantages in that, yes, I could, you know, escape into a book. I could, you know, I had some tools that were given to me by the grace of God to imagine a better future. And I think that that really plays into a young person's ability to overcome whatever circumstances they're that are put in front of them. And I was so fortunate in so many ways that that even though my family story is one that involved addiction.
Alcoholism. Yeah.
It's I don't look at it as a bleak story at all.
I hear that from you, and that's fascinating to me that you being affected by alcoholism had that resilience, and you had mentioned when we were talking earlier you had hope, you saw a future, and maybe your mother and others gave you that.
Absolutely. But, you know, when I realized that my mother, for example, as all of this turmoil was going on in her life, and she literally she's got two young kids.
Bound to save you guys.
You know, husband who is
disappointing her every minute.
And you know what she does is in the same breath, you know, leaves her husband and enrolls in graduate school because she knows that she needs, you know, if she gets a master's degree working for the school system, it's going to mean more income. So that she could support, you know, two children, and that she would, focus on that. You know, that was, you do talk about a story of resilience.
I was just going to say, what do you think made her that way? Because so many mothers end up addicted to the alcoholic and end up in the same path.
I think my mother was the classic overachiever in her own family. Was the first and only in her immediate family to attend college and graduate from college, and so I think she had a level of determination that this was not going to beat her.
Wow.
That this was not going to beat her. And that was just an incredible lesson for me that, you know, if she could do all of that in the midst of this massive change, you know, there's really no excuses for me in terms of what I should be able to do.
So she was an excellent role model.
Yes, she was. Yes, she was.
And your father, if in spite of the alcoholism, sounds like he was very proud of you were.
My father was college educated. You know, he and I share a name. Those of you who read the newspaper and see my byline, you know, Mizell Stewart III. You know, Dad was Mizell Stewart Jr. I mean, we share the name and a lot more. And he was a very intelligent man, very much achievement oriented. I think that, you know, it was for a black man. In the late 1960s, the early 1970s, you know, it was literally, you know, in the post civil rights era, I will call that, it was not easy for an African American man to gain a foothold.
And, especially in a big city,
and being challenged, and literally being challenged at every turn. And I think my dad's response to being challenged was, alcohol. I think helped him. You know, it was a gregarious guy. You know, I think alcohol, provided a sense of power and a sense of control. I really do. And
it's seductive how powerful alcohol can be.
And I think it caused him to dream even bigger dreams than he might have had he not been doing that. And my dad went to law school, wanted to be a lawyer, and a couple credits short of graduation, he decided he didn't want to be a lawyer anymore. Of course, this is after my mom practically put him through law school.
Little impulsive personality there.
I don't know. I just remember snippets of conversation around that, but I just knew that he was also a man of ambition, and I do think that the ambition both of my mother and my father did certainly rubbed off on me.
Absolutely. So when you started going to school, especially junior high, high school, knowing alcoholism was the cause of the breakup of your family, did you associate with other kids that also came from the same kind of background? Did you talk about it with other kids, or was it something you just didn't talk about?
Well, actually, I did have close friends who had that going on in their own families. I mean, not in not at the level was happening in my own family, but certainly where alcohol use was very present and very present and very prevalent. And we did talk about it.
So you weren't told don't ever take this out of the house, or did you get a message?
No. I mean, as a family, we were all all very open, all open about it. I mean, Dad died when I was 14.
Of alcoholism?
He died of alcoholism. And what was interesting about at the time of his death was it was a period, he died literally months after we began to kind of rekindle a relationship after having been apart for really having no contact for about 5 years. And
did he make amends? Did he come back? And
well, he it was one of those things where, he seemed like he was getting it together, but you could tell that physically he was not right. But he had begun to make amends to the family. My mother agreed to allow my brother and I to see him and visit with him, and we had a good visit. But literally 3 months after that last visit, we got the phone call that he had died, and he died alone.
Jeez.
In an Efficiency apartment.
Sober?
No.
So he never got sober.
And wasn't found for a number of days.
Oh, my.
And that was, I'd say the power of that, when you leave this earth alone, I can't imagine. You leave this earth really without, without a loving family around you. You leave this earth without a sustaining faith.
The degradation of alcoholism.
I just try to imagine it. I think if I have one. If there's one wish and one regret, it's that somebody didn't try to help Dad get in some kind of program.
So he never did that you know of?
Not that I know of. I mean, not that I know of that he ever really tried to or have access to or encouragement to get.
Treatment.
Get help. I mean, this was the early early 70s. I mean,
a lot of denial still.
I don't know whether at that period of at that period.
No, you didn't even really. Yeah,
there was AA.
Right, but
and if you met somebody, you were invited into the club, so to speak. But aside from that,
it was so anonymous. You didn't. That's true.
There's a reason you call it Alcoholics Anonymous.
Well, and I'll tell you another secret. We were so worried about drugs. Post-Vietnam, mm-hmm. the drugs, the heroin, and then cocaine, that alcoholism wasn't as talked about.
Absolutely.
And is out of the closet yet. So he may not have, like you said, even known about the resources. But that he came and talked to you, that's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
And made amends to you.
Yeah, he did. He did. And it was a wonderful opportunity to say what needed to be said, and God blesses in that way.
Yeah.
God blesses in that way, and when he had an opportunity to express his regret for the way things had turned out as well.
That's an incredible thing for a 14-year-old boy in 7th or 8th grade to hear and to see his father come back and be a man about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but there's so many, there's so many families out there and so many people who are affected by this.
One out of four.
And again, who haven't had or didn't have the advantages and the opportunities that I've had. And so again, I don't share that story to demonstrate anything except that it that a lot of us have that and have had those
have that history
experiences and that
but that you have gratitude about the way you were able to shape yourself and that your family helped shape you through that. That's incredible.
Yeah,
well, don't go away, Tri-State. We're going to take a little break and we're going to come back and continue talking to Mizell Stewart III about what has shaped his life and how he gives back to the community, some of his ideas and impressions and opinions and experiences about alcoholism and how it affected him and what he hopes to take from it for the community's sake. So don't go away. We'll be right back.
Hey, you. Yeah, you listening to the radio. It's me again. Have you got that HIV test yet? As I mentioned before, if you have put yourself at risk by having unprotected sex with more than one person or used IV drugs, guess what? You've put yourself at risk for HIV. Make that appointment today by calling the Vandenberg County Health Department at 435-5683 or stop by 420 East Mulberry. It's that easy. Remember, everything is confidential. No one has to know you've gotten the test unless you tell them, so do it. What do you have to lose except maybe your life or your partner's life? When in doubt, get checked out.
AutoZone.
Keep your car performing at its peak all winter. Make a trip to AutoZone.
Get in the zone. AutoZone.
Before you take on the winter roads, get to AutoZone and get everything you need for cold weather driving. Right now, save a dollar when you improve your engine's performance and fuel economy with a 5 1/4 ounce model of Lucas Fuel Treatment and Injector Cleaner for just $4.99. Get ready to ride out the winter. Get to AutoZone today.
Get in the zone. AutoZone.
Now, anywhere cough and cold strikes, Pure Robitussin Relief is ready to go anywhere you go. Introducing new Robitussin to Go. The cough and cold symptom relief you want in a neat little single dose spoon that goes anywhere. New Robitussin to Go. The medicine has already been dissolved, ready for your body to take in. Anytime, anywhere. New Robitussin to Go. Pure Robitussin Relief to Go.
Use as directed. Medicine works over time.
Hello, Evansville. This is Marcus T. Watkins, the minister of the Lion Street Church of Christ, and we invite you to tune in Monday through Friday to our Drive Time Meditation, 7 o'clock a.m. and 4:50 p.m. right here on 1400 The Pump. And remember, when you come by the Lion Street Church of Christ, it'll end your search for a friendly church.
This is Walt Baby Love. It's Grammy weekend, y'all. It's a big one for Maxwell, Charlie Wilson, and Melanie Fiona. I've got their hits plus live in our countdown studio. Jazz saxophonist Kirk Whalum, he's got a brand new gospel album out. I've got him plus his new hit with Layla Hathaway. Don't miss the countdown this weekend right here with Walt Baby Love.
Since 1997, WEOA has broadcast pre-recorded services from area churches. In response to the growth of media ministry, WEOA currently has the following 30-minute time slots available Sunday on a first response basis: 3 p.m., 7 p.m., 8 p.m., and 8:30 p.m. Radio ministry extends your ministry outside the four walls of the church, reaches the sick and shut in, attracts new members, and can be used as an outreach opportunity to those incarcerated. The radio ministry also includes weekly promotional announcements, reminding listeners to tune in to your broadcast. If your church would like to expand their message beyond the confines of the church, give WEOA a call at 812-424-8864 or 1-888-846-7867.
You're listening to And So It Goes on 1400 AM WEOA The Pump. We encourage you to call in right now at 424-1400 or 1-888-846-7867. And now, back to And So It Goes.
Really? Welcome back, Tri-State, to our conversation with Mizell Stewart III, who's the editor of our newspaper, The Courier and Press, that keeps us informed of what's going on everywhere all the time. Mizell, I love The Courier and Press.
Well, I'm glad you do.
Yes.
You know, the thing about editing a newspaper is that we really try to reflect the entire community. There are always going to be things that come up in the news, opinions that are expressed, ideas mm-hmm. that are shared that, you know, you pick up the paper one day and you say, oh my goodness, what were they thinking? But the idea is we've got to hold up a mirror to the community and to do so in a way that's respectful, to do so in a way that tries to build community rather than to tear it down. And one of the things that we see a great deal is just the impact of substance abuse and in the community. I came up as a journalist as a police reporter, and
now that was an exciting place to report, I'm sure.
Well, I will say that, you know, my early reporting days were spent on the police beat in Dayton, Ohio. And I literally got on the beat right as crack cocaine hit that community. There were gangs from Detroit who mm-hmm. brought it down. Mm-hmm. But the homegrown guys in Dayton learned how to make rock cocaine, and there were literally gun battles in the streets with guys from Detroit and guys from Dayton fighting
the
over
gangs.
Territory. Absolutely. Mm. And it wasn't even a gang thing. I mean, it was not, you know, these were just individual groups, were too loosely organized to call them a gang.
Wow, just dealers.
Just dealers. And I literally watched crack cocaine overtake a community. And the mothers mm-hmm. that I interviewed of sons who died in the trade, the girlfriends who lost their boyfriends, and the little kids who lost their fathers, all because of this little rock of cocaine and baking soda. I mean, I just,
what an eye opener for you.
But it really was an object lesson, you know, and drawing on that the experiences that that I shared about growing up in an alcoholic home. When people said that they
considered crack to be the most addictive drug that had hit to that point.
You know, no doubt I was not going there.
The idea that, and I had, and I had family members and my members of my extended family who used, and I'll never forget a conversation. I was visiting some of them, some of that came out, and you want some? I said no. And they said, you know, you never did want to go into that kind of stuff. And I said, you know what? You're right. And
this was your own family?
That. This is my own family.
So it's not the dealers from Indy we need to be worried about. It's our own cousins and neighbors.
Well, exactly. When you think about how most people are introduced to
That's
something
right.
new.
It's not the big dealers from out of town.
It's not the mythical drug dealer in at the edge of the schoolyard.
That's right. You're right.
It's somebody you know.
That's for sure.
It's somebody you know. It's somebody you trust who's saying, hey, you know, how'd you like to try this?
Mm-hmm. But what made you say no?
Well, first of all, I mean, just, you know, being a journalist, you see firsthand the impact.
Yeah.
Of this. I mean, you know, seeing the impact of alcoholism is one thing, but seeing the impact of, cocaine, crack, and now meth use, when you see the impact of that up close, you know, you have to kind of ask yourself the question, is the pleasure that I'm ostensibly going to get from this worth what I have the potential to lose over the long term. And I don't know.
You were able to think that through.
Well, I watched my father lose everything. You know.
Do you think there's some similarities between what you saw with crack cocaine, what you've now seen with methamphetamine, and what you experienced as a child with alcoholism?
Certainly, I haven't seen meth and crack as up close and personal as alcoholism in my own family. But I do believe that we were talking during the break about whether or not alcoholism is a disease. I mean, I believe that, and I do believe that there is a tendency, whether genetic
An
or
allergy.
Otherwise,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Whether genetic or otherwise, there is a propensity for addiction.
Right.
We've talked about when you have a parent who is addicted, that the offspring is more likely statistically to become addicted either by replicated behavior or by genetics. And so knowing that, mm-hmm. you have to be on a little bit more guard. But again, it goes back to this sense from my standpoint of I think when addiction begins to take over, I believe that it takes over in part because addiction provides an escape that dreaming of a better future doesn't.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, you don't necessarily think that there's something better out there for you, and so to give way to the addiction and the momentary pleasure is that way of escape.
Some people dream. That's right.
Some people use and when you have a drink and there was a time where I personally drank more than I do, and you have that drink at the end of the day. What are you doing? Just got to have it to relax.
Mm-hmm.
But should you really?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things that I've had to consider in my own life. And again, you talk about being shaped by experience. What you choose to
do or use to get that release, that relief, that escape. What my childhood taught me is that using substances to get that is probably going to lead to a loss, and I like my life too much to lose.
Well, I thought it was profound that you said people with a purpose or that believe there's opportunity for them are maybe less likely.
Yeah. Yeah,
especially with the illegal drugs.
When I think about some of my cousins who probably are addicted, but don't have the education, don't have anything other than really their present existence. I think that using as an escape has become their part of their lifestyle, because there's not something else.
That's right.
There's not something else out there.
And it does become a lifestyle, an image, a culture, a language. Yeah. You're right.
And
it does.
I think that we've got to. I think one of the reasons I think people are drawn to. Are drawn to faith and expressions of faith, and I think one of the reasons that the 12-step type programs are a lot of them are
faith
based.
Yes,
is because that is an opportunity to fill that void.
I think you're right.
It's an opportunity.
Fill that hole in the soul.
Absolutely, and
with the camaraderie of others like yourself, for sure.
And the fellowship.
Yes, yes.
The fellowship
that
is such an important part of that. And if
have you ever been to an AA meeting?
I have not.
I need to take you.
I worked for a number of years in Akron, Ohio, and those.
Oh my God, that's where AA started.
Absolutely, those who are familiar with AA.
That's right.
The first meeting was
St. Thomas Hospital in Akron, Ohio. That's right.
And every year in Akron,
in June.
There is literally
convention.
A pilgrimage,
right.
And one of those powerful sights is when you see every Sunday during that Founders Weekend, there is a motorcycle parade to Bill W.'s grave.
And Dr. Bob Smith as well,
and
yes.
Dr. Bob as well. And to see all of those,
all
those
different walks
on
of life,
motorcycles,
that amazing,
riding through the streets, and people coming together from all different walks of life. I mean, if I have one regret about my childhood, it was that I was unable.
You were
to
so isolated.
Expose my father to that,
and he was isolated. I guess.
If there's anything that I could change, if there's anything I could change about that, that would be the thing that I would. Mm-hmm. That'd be the thing that would change. But getting back to as a reporter, covering the explosion of cocaine. I mean, it was you think about it, the early 80s, and people just looking for a good time. But man, that was an insidious
hijacked your brain so quickly.
Insidious drug, and
it still is. It's still here.
In the popular imagination, I think meth has really methamphetamine in the popular imagination, I think, has really taken over. And the thing that that really really troubles me about meth is that on the one hand, you don't see the same level of associated violence with methamphetamine as we saw during the 80s with crack cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
But the reason is because people are essentially their own suppliers.
It's in their own backyard.
They're pulling together the ingredients on their own, or getting it from a friend, and that kind of thing. And what and meth is really having an impact on families.
Yes, the neglect
to a degree that crack didn't have. It's almost as though, you know, meth is something that the family does.
Mm-hmm. Family's definitely affected.
And you know, whereas, maybe crack was
out in the streets more.
In the streets more. Meth is happening within the home.
It's true.
And not only within the home, but, you know, we've seen in our own community where, you know, husbands and wives, mothers and fathers are using, and how we penetrate that as a community and address that, I think, is really going to be one of the major issues of our time.
Do you think the newspaper is the global campfire, as you called it, which was a neat way to say it? It is a global campfire, a way to keep the discussions and maybe help some of the, do you think they read the newspaper, people suffering from this and their families? And is the newspaper a vehicle to help people find some hope and opportunity to get out of the hole?
Well, I think right now, you know, really what the newspaper does at this point is to just literally reflect what's going on. I mean, we had a story last year called Failing Caleb, which was a story that literally began with methamphetamine. For those of you who may not recall, this was a look at the life and death of Caleb Lay. Mm-hmm. This was a young man who unfortunately died at the hands of his mother and father, but their story, the story of Amanda Brooks and Terry Lay, was also an addiction story. They first became known to the authorities where they were living at the time in southern Illinois because of a meth lab operating in their apartment, and that, you know, meth use and abuse became a constant in that family, and significantly affected how they cared for or failed to care for their children. Mm-hmm. And I think that there are
Newspaper reflected that,
and there are countless cases out there. I mean, last year we went through a series of cases of children who were abused or neglected, where meth use was either evident or suspected. I mean, I think the challenge for us as a newspaper, I think the challenge for us as a community is to identify solutions. I mean, I think this program is one of those ways, because it's a place where people can come and talk openly and share their stories. And so I think
you wouldn't believe how open people are willing to be. You know, the owner of our station here has just been amazed at how open and honest people are willing to be about their story, especially if they think it'll help someone else, like you sharing.
I mean, I think that if people don't know, especially among African Americans, I mean, if people don't know and don't talk about how they overcame, it's going to be very difficult to find that hope. You know, if a young person, you know, is listening, for example, and is dealing with addiction in his or her own family, you know, it's all about setting your sights on, you know, what is the future you want for yourself. And yes, we can be concerned about mom. Yes, we can be concerned about dad. But what is the future you want for yourself, and can you find somebody that you can confide in to share your story and what you're dealing with?
And that is so key, and I think that's what Alcoholics Anonymous and Narcotics Anonymous provide. Somebody to help bring you out of the ditch.
Well, it goes back to that fellowship.
Yes.
And when you're alone, that was how my, you know, think about it. That was how my dad died. I mean, alone, with, you know, not with anybody, not connected to anybody. Nobody noticed he was gone.
Mizell, it's so interesting, though, that now you've taken the rest of your life and your story from that with your father to making sure no one's alone. And when you read the paper, you don't feel alone. It's interesting. Your career helps bring people into feeling that sense of connectedness.
It does. I mean, I think that, the newspaper is not perfect and the media in general is not perfect. I mean, I think that we have... We continue to have an opportunity to bring stories to light that are not just the three-paragraph meth lab brief with a mugshot.
Right, right.
You know, I mean, if there's one thing that troubles me about what we do, it's that all too often we're focused on that. And not the not why and that was where the story of Caleb Lay comes in is really in peeling back the veil and trying to identify where are some of these solutions. I mean,
right.
we've written about the drug courts in Vandenberg and Warren counties as being potential solutions because. One
Definitely.
Of the things that has happened is that, the reason the
But that's just for people that get busted. Your dad
reasons,
never got busted. Where do people like him go?
He didn't. He didn't. But I think the thing we've got to keep in mind is that one of the products of that crack cocaine
era.
Binge of the, the 80s was to criminalize drugs to a level... That is really going to bring our society to a point where we've got to make a decision.
Yeah.
How much money are we willing to spend on incarceration versus how much money
That's
are we
true.
Willing to spend on treatment?
Yeah.
You're looking...
it is time we look as a community.
I mean, in California, for example, the prison population has exploded to the point where... That is going to be that state's second largest expense. Mm. And as a society, I think we have to ask ourselves, are we willing to devote that much of the state's resources to, speaking California terms,
nonviolent people.
To nonviolent drug offenders as compared to dealers,
yes.
as compared to distributors, as compared to manufacturers.
Yeah, the sentencing is unbelievable. I know Judge Trockman's been at legislation trying to even do something about the sentencing as well as employment,
right.
helping people be employed, and Judge
right.
Meyer as
and,
well.
And in fact, speaking of Judge Trockman, I mean, he wrote a piece in the Courier
a couple weeks ago
mm-hmm. that I think really was a poignant reminder that this drug court's been established in Vandenberg County,
a decade.
People are coming out of that program and really have success stories to share. But if they can't graduate from that program and find employment.
That's right.
If they can't graduate from that program and find a purpose, the running thread through this whole conversation for the past hour has been, having a sense of a future.
A purpose-driven life.
Something to dream about.
Yes.
Something to shoot for. And in the absence of that, there's alcohol, there's crack, there's meth. I mean, all these things are waiting. It's like, come party with me and,
yeah, that's a pretty quick fix.
Later.
Right, right.
We've got to make sure that the people who choose a path toward a dream have something to dream about.
Yes.
Something to look for.
Well, I think... This hour has gone too fast. I hope you will come back.
Absolutely.
It has been wonderful meeting you, getting to know you, Mizell, and to see that this newspaper is something close to your heart. It's not just your career.
Absolutely. It is. It really has been, when I think about my life, my parents are gone now. I still have the paper.
That's right, and you provide that global campfire for us. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Tell us real quickly, we've got a couple minutes, about your television show that WNIN airs called Lawmakers.
Yes, we
The Courier and Press and WNIN do a couple of weekly television programs, and right now the Indiana General Assembly is in session.
Right.
And so every Friday at 10 o'clock and every Sunday morning at 11:30, we have lawmakers where a couple of members of the state legislative delegation from southwestern Indiana sit down with me, and we talk about what has transpired in the past week in the legislative session, and take a look ahead. And you know, thinking about what, tapping into what state government does, I think is very important for our part of the state.
Mm-hmm.
Evansville and you know, Vanderburgh, Posey, Gibson, Ward counties, I mean, I think are taken for granted up in Indianapolis. And we're very fortunate in this area to have, no matter what your political affiliation is, I think we're very fortunate in this area to have a very cohesive state legislative delegation that works together for the betterment of southwestern Indiana. I have lived and worked in three different states and have been involved in state government and state politics in all of those places. And I have never seen a group of elected officials work more closely together in what is, once you get up to Indianapolis, is a pretty partisan environment. But you know, we have Democrats and Republicans who are elected to represent us in the legislature and the Senate, and it's a very, very effective group of people.
How exciting! So we can tune into that Fridays at 10.
Absolutely, and then after the legislative session, we will segue into another show called Newsmakers, and Lisa, I'm going to have you, I'm going to return the favor and have you come on my Newsmakers show.
Wow, make some show, news!
Absolutely, that show airs at those same times. But what we talk about are just those issues that are on the table for the community, from from the Arena Project to you know, one of the most powerful interviews I had lately was a lady who herself overcame substance abuse to become an advocate for the homeless and an advocate for homeless persons in supportive housing. So we have some interesting guests.
There you go. Yes.
There.
Awesome. Well, we will have you back here too, and we'll see you on Lawmakers, Newsmakers, and we'll get to see Mizell every day at the Courier Press. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Well, Radio Rehab, it has been an incredibly informative and inspiring hour. Thanks for tuning in. We will see you again next Saturday. Between now and then, don't forget to do the next right thing.